Welcome to The Right Chamber,
the podcast where we dive deep into the fascinating world of medicine and healthcare.
In every episode, we will talk about pivotal topics relating to medicine and surgery in the UK and what it's like to be a healthcare professional today. We are inviting doctors and other healthcare professionals across different specialties to discuss their experiences and give an insight into what their journey has been like. Please follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS and subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media. So sit back, ignore the traffic, and enjoy the Right Chamber podcast. Dr. Richard Aleem, a palliative medicine consultant since 2014, primarily serves the community. Over the past 3 years, he's also been a well-being champion for resident doctors. His dedication in both roles earned him the prestigious Medical Directors Committed to Excellence Award in 2023.
Welcome back to the Right Chamber podcast. My name is Jasfri and
I am Victor.
Today we have Dr. Richard Aleem, one of our palliative consultants.
Hello.
Richard, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Richard Aleem. I'm one of the palliative care consultants, like you've just said. But I'm also the wellbeing champion for resident doctors and have done this role for about 3 years now. So I do palliative care 3 days a week. And then this is something I do on my fourth day. So, yeah.
And how has working in palliative care made you want to become a wellbeing
That's a good question. I think the thing about palliative care is, for me personally, I can't speak for anyone else, but for me, it's a it's a very emotionally challenging job. We're obviously dealing with a very sensitive time of life for patients, and then we often see those patients die, and it can be really distressing. And if you're not boundaried, if you don't care for yourself, I think palliative care has got the potential to really not harm you, but it might sort of make you struggle emotionally. That's what I was finding anyway. And I think through that, I learned that I had to really look after myself. And I think in addition to that, in palliative care, we spend most of our time our biggest tool is communication and talking to people. And so when just after COVID, when I took up this role, I think it was the communication side of it that made me interested in wellbeing, because I just wanted to talk to resident doctors. I wanted to see how people were. I wanted to connect with people, support them. And that's just what I enjoy doing. It's why I do palliative care, and it's sort of why I do wellbeing. So that's my sort of ingredient mix and why I've started doing wellbeing.
That's interesting that you mentioned that you chose this pathway after COVID. Could you visibly see that there were resident doctors struggling?
I could. I mean, it wasn't me that chose it, to be fair. I went to Mr. Raymond and said, are there any additional roles that I could do? Because I worked 3 days a week in palliative care. My kids had then started to go to school, so I had a spare day. Huh. So I just came to Mr. Raymond and said, is there anything that you can think of me doing? And he said, I've got this idea for this wellbeing role, and he put it to me, and I was like, yeah, let's do it. So straight after COVID, and it wasn't just me noticing it, everyone could see that resident doctors were really struggling. It's well documented, the burnout levels during COVID, post COVID. I don't think we've really fully recovered from that since. So COVID was a hard time. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. The pressure that resident doctors are under, it feels like it's not really changed. If anything, it's probably worsened. Worsened over the years, and the amount of work that's needed and things that are asked of them. It makes me think of kind of traditionally, well-being probably wasn't that big of a hot topic, I guess, in previous years, but over more years, it's becoming more and more of a topic of discussion. I mean, why do you think that is? It's becoming more...
Well, you know, you say previous years. In the old days, well, my old days anyway, it was certainly well-being was never even a consideration. When I was a junior doctor, when I was doing my foundation years and so on, it might have been something that was, you know, your supervisors would care about you, but it was never talked about as a thing. I never even heard of the idea of well-being until many years later. But I think, you know, junior doctor surveys, there are RCP surveys that are done. The evidence is when they've asked people how they're getting on, the rates of burnout and mental health issues due to workload and work pressures is really significant. You know, not just in resident doctors, but also in consultants. And, you know, the pressure is really high. And I think for me, the challenge is that we're not, you know, the work is the work. We have to look after our patients. We have to put patients first. But to do that, you have to look after yourself. So the priority is how do we care for patients safely? And a feed into that is how do you look after yourself? So there was a document called Caring for Doctors, Caring for Patients, which I think was a bit of a landmark document from back in 2018, which really sort of highlighted the issues with what was going on with sort of burnout and stress for resident doctors. And then, of course, COVID hit in 2020. So just after that. So I think it's over the past sort of 10 or just less than 10 years, the recognition of the challenge in working in medicine has been increasingly recognized, which is a really good thing. Because then out of that, the question is, well, what are we able to do about it? How can we support people? And I think my role then came out of that. But I think, you know, when I talk to resident doctors about well-being and so on, I think we have to separate it from sort of the amount of work that we have to do, because at the end of the day, our hospitals are often full, that patients are pouring in. At the end of the day, the workload is the workload. But the question is, can we support the way that we deal with the associated pressures and stresses? How can we support resident doctors? How can we look after ourselves to do that? And I think that's where perhaps my role comes in, checking in with people, thinking through strategies of how they can maybe manage their workload better or prioritize in a different way or sort of manage their work-life balance. So those sorts of things.
But I assume like people who are struggling and they want help, just look for it. But what about the residents or just hospital staff who are struggling but hesitant to speak? How do you approach that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the people that don't speak up, so there might be a number of reasons for that. One might be they don't know what support is available. And therefore, I think one of the, not campaigns, but one of the things I'm keen to raise is awareness of the wellbeing services that are here in Dudley where we work. And I have to say that the opportunities and the care in Dudley, you know, from my perspective, is really good. I know what goes on in some other hospitals and I know what they provide isn't quite up to what we do here in Dudley. But there's something about awareness, first of all. And I think there's a perception about well-being as well, where it feels a bit wishy-washy or it feels a bit like, and I think particularly I've noticed it for locally employed doctors, so doctors that have come from abroad, who maybe culturally well-being is something that's certainly
taboo.
Not taboo or something. That's right. And so even though I may invite people to come, they might think, oh, I don't want to go to that in case it get reported for something or whatever. So there's that level of thing. And then the third thing is that, yes, the person who disengages from support might be the person who really needs help.
But because it's interesting that it wasn't very well known in the olden days, I always think that maybe some people think that just raising that they need help is looked as a sign of weakness.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't want to speak out. And like you said, like they're scared of like being reported or like being diagnosed with mental health is, like you said, culturally, some cultures find that as taboo, like mental health does not exist. Yeah.
You remember from the application forms, you know, it's like, what are the signs of resilience? You know, I have qualities, I can be resilient in this way, in that way. And it's, you know, it's a great thing. But then is there a limit to where actually it's getting too much, and perhaps being resilient isn't the best option at this point? Actually, should you seek some help? And recognizing that, I think, can be a bit challenging, especially for a competitive field like medicine and surgery, where it's all about just, keep pushing, keep going.
You know, basically, if everyone's got their own sort of limits of what they can and can't do, I would say, and that they are different for different people. But, you know, pressure is an important part of what we do as doctors, isn't it? I mean, you only get through your exams because there's a pressure on you, and you know there's a deadline and you've got to pass that. So we're all very acquainted with pressure and deadlines and so on. But the problem comes when that pressure is so much that you just don't have the skills or the sort of resource, the energy, the mental capacity, for want of a better word, to know how to deal with that. But often it's to do with the tools that you're using. So for example, you could have two people who are faced with the same clinical situation. It's just that, and it might be that person A has learned how to manage this and feels quite comfortable in this situation. Person B feels very overwhelmed and is finding it really distressing. But actually, if we equip that person with the tools, with the right training, with the right support, then they might be able to handle that situation quite differently next time. So there's something, you know, the way that we all handle stress, is like the way I handle it to the way you handle it, is probably quite different. But it's about sort of working out what tools are available, and not just sort of working out for yourself. And I think that's the problem, is like, if I'm feeling stressed and I put my hand up and say, I'm really not sure how to do this, then the benefit of that is that somebody can say, Richard, this is what you could do. Have you thought about doing this? But if I don't put my hand up and I just struggle on, then I'm never going to improve.
Yeah.
So that there is a taboo. There is a feeling that it's sort of wishy-washy or not that, or it's a sign of weakness. But actually, to me, it's a sign of somebody saying, do you know what? I want to develop, and this is a really, really important part of you as a doctor, as a person, like developing and learning how to navigate life, because life is really difficult. And sorry, I'm just going on here, but actually what happens for resident doctors, because it happens to everybody, is that you might be sailing through your foundation years, but then what if something happens, like there's a bereavement in your family, or there's a relationship breakdown, or you find some sort of financial distress, or, you know, something outside of your work life, you know, knocks you. It's like, well, that's going to have an impact on your working life, and suddenly your capacity to look after your patients is going to be sort of thrown out of sync. You're going to be like, I don't really know how to navigate this. So mechanisms for coping and putting your hand up for support, because you know, when a bereavement happens, who knows how to navigate that, for example. You know, and it's hard, and you need to put your hand up and say, look, I'm finding this tough. And there is support available. That's the thing. There is support available.
And I think, like, on the topic of support, what are some of the practical things that we have in place at the moment, just if you have a few?
Yeah, so first of all, so sort of working from ground up on the wards, you've got your sort of peer support. And I think peer support is really important. And one of the things that we talk about in our sort of wellbeing pizza Wednesday things that I do for the resident doctors, we talk about the importance of peer support. And we do it in the Thriving in Medicine course that we run for foundation years as well. The reason peer support is so important is because if you say, oh, I'm really struggling with this problem, whatever it is, and there's someone else and they share that with another person, And that other person says, do you know what? I'm struggling with that as well.
Mm.
Or I've struggled with
that. You know you're not alone.
You know, suddenly you know you're not alone. It's that sort of Me Too thing. Because when that hashtag Me Too thing happened in 2017, I think it was, like when one person was brave enough to put their hand up, so many other people put their hand up and said, so peer support is really important. So we've got that. And then we've got, you know, your clinical supervisors, your educational supervisors. So you've got your clinical supervisor who's on the ground with you. You've got your educational supervisors. They are people that you can turn to. They understand the challenges on resident doctor wards. They get it. Obviously, there's going to be a variation in what your ES or CS can provide you with, depending on personality or how available they are, or whatever it is. So there is variation. Beyond that, we have resources on our hub website, so the staff and wellbeing website, which is really good. There's a lot of free resources, so that includes written documents to support you through, I don't know, it could be just how to manage stress or your mental health or whatever. There's videos, there's podcasts, there's apps. So the I can't remember what it's called. It's a meditation app with an orange circle. What's it called?
Headspace. Yes.
So I'm pretty sure that's still up there for free at the moment.
Wow.
So there's apps that are available, and then beyond that, so there's what I do, which is my check-ins with resident doctors. My offer is not just open to resident doctors; it's offered open to anyone in the trust. I've met with consultants even. Mm. So if anyone wants to talk to me about what they're going through from a wellbeing perspective, I'm here. I'm easy to access.
I remember one of those check-ins that I think you had with me back in my F1. So for context for everyone listening, so I did both my FY1 and FY2 year over here in Dudley.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. You had a check-in, I think, with every single F1 doctor at some point.
And FT, and that's what we still do,
And still going on. So I remember I was about 1 or 2 months into my general surgery job, my, you know, fresh doctor, adjusting to the new environment. I remember we had the scheduled time and it was a video conversation as well. And I thought it was just very lovely to have that check in, and it wasn't just a how are you doing kind of thing. It was actually, you know, you were finding out about me and, you know, things that I liked to do, what do I do in my free time, how am I finding a job. And I found in my situation then, I remember, I think I was at that point, I was dealing with everything quite well. But I can imagine with someone else, perhaps someone who is new to the city. So I'm quite thankful because my family isn't so far away. But I can imagine someone who's new to the city, someone who doesn't know anyone, or perhaps haven't established a friendship group or something like that. That conversation would have made such a difference. So I think it's so important. So that was my experience. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, that's right. And I think ultimately, you know, I did check in with you and generally ask people how they're doing at work, the support they're getting, about, like you've said, your hobbies, your interests, how do you get your downtime, how do you look after yourself. I generally ask people to sort of self-rate their mental health out of 10. But, you know, I think which is really good. And you were in a good place and that's great. But if you hadn't have been, the options would have been that we either follow up and we see you again, or I see you again, or I refer you on to somewhere more professional for support. So we've got counselling that I think it's amazing. Dudley pays for counselling.
Wow.
So Dudley Group, I mean. So we have, you know, it might take you months to get counselling through your GP, but we can access it really quickly here in Dudley because we pay for this service. And then beyond that, it might be that, you know, there's a professional support unit as part of the deanery. There's different ways that we can care for and support for people. But that meeting that I have with people is generally a screening sort of tool to say, if there's a problem, can we pick it up? Because someone's not going to necessarily put their hand up. But if we're proactive about it and say, hey, how are you?
Yeah, because I think people are just scared to say that I need help. I'm struggling, and you can pick that up and say that, I can help you at surface level, but you might need a little bit of more professional help.
Yeah.
Because I know that people who think that mental health is looked at as weakness will never go out themselves and look for therapy sessions.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to say, because actually, you know, you can see a broken arm, but you can't see a broken brain.
Yeah.
Straight off. And I think, I don't mean to call it a broken brain, but you know what I mean. So when you've got stuff going on, you can't see, you know, we all try and put on a front that looks the part, right? But you don't know what's going on in someone's life. And that's the sort of insight, or the privilege of doing those well-being meetings, is that I say to people, just how are you? Tell me what's going on. And honestly, the stuff that resident doctors have been going through, alongside having to try and hold down, you know, do their work and get, you know, the ward round prepared and all the jobs done, the stuff that people are dealing with at the same time, I mean, it's hard to sort of put it into words, really, but people are struggling with stuff.
What are the most common issues, do you think, that new resident doctors are dealing with?
I think new resident doctors, I mean, I think that's fairly common, because in the sense that you're starting a new job, new environment, scared of doing something wrong. You know, there's a commonality with the themes when you first start. When you become an F2, you know, the pressures change. You're thinking about what you're going to do in your sort of F3 year, or what specialty. You know, so the pressures change along the way. As people are preparing for their ARCPs, the pressure is different. So everyone's got those sort of common stresses and pressures along the way. Different wards will have different pressures. So some wards are much harder than others to work in. Some people find certain staff groups more challenging than others. You know, that's the reality of the situation. But alongside, like I say, people come with then unique stuff on top of that in their personal lives. They've got their own health problems. They've got their family problems. They're dealing with all sorts of stuff.
I think it's funny because you know, when you said the hashtag Me Too thing, you know, when you sit down and talk to a little bit more senior resident doctors, someone always has a story about how they cried in their first year, and like the spaces that they used in their F1s to cry, like the locker room, or, you know, just one of the hidden toilets. I cried on my third day. I cried for the whole day until someone was like, what do you want?
It's frightening, isn't it? Like becoming a resident doctor for the first time, coming up as an FY1. And I remember I was terrified to prescribe paracetamol. You know, it was just like, but I didn't tell anybody. And I just sort of lived with this fear for a long time, or like preparing for ward rounds in my cardiology job. I was just terrified of it, you know. Probably didn't need to be, but it just, I wanted to do my best, and I was a perfectionist, and that's a pressure that I put on myself, you know. It's hard.
I think it's always that fear that, like, oh, especially with new resident doctors, they always have that fear that their GMC license is going to be taken away because they prescribed paracetamol wrong, or, you know.
But we want to support, you know, this. I really believe that Russell's Hall is a really supportive hospital if you know where to look. And if you sort of realise that there are opportunities to get support, I just wish more people would put their hand up and say, can I have a meeting with you? Some of the senior doctors here are really good. They if they spot a problem with a resident doctor, they refer to me and say, Richard, could you meet up with this person? And like, I really appreciate that. So if there are any consultants listening and you have junior doctors that you'd like a bit of support, then please do tell them to get in touch or put us in touch via email.
I think just kind of going to like a practical level of your day-to-day resident doctors, do you have any like suggestions on things that we can do in our day-to-day work to keep our well-being in check and, you know, protect mental health and make sure we can be the best doctors for our patients that we can be.
I mean, it's a huge question and that you're asking, and there's many, many ways to do that. Just on a day-to-day basis then, to start with, I would suggest that, you know, as a resident doctor, if you're a new doctor, you don't know this. If you're an older doctor, maybe you do. But as a new doctor, you tend not to know how to prioritize jobs very well. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that. So, like I said at the beginning, we can't do anything about the volume of patients coming in or the number of jobs. But what you can do is the way that you approach them. And if, so I've had done some coaching with some resident doctors on just how to, when they're writing their job list, don't just write an endless list of jobs.
Hmm.
Prioritize, write them in a sort of urgent, but it's going to take a long time, or not so urgent, but can be done quickly. You know, sort of separating out your job list is really important. Knowing how to do that is really important. So that's, I would say, critical. And I think FY1 doctors probably don't know how to do that very well. Hmm. And because they don't know how to do that very well, they just feel overwhelmed. And to-do lists can feel overwhelming if they're not organized properly, as in terms of urgency and sort of how quickly they need to be done. So there's that. I'd say the second thing is to make sure that you're sharing and supporting your colleagues on your local wards. So if you work with other FY1s, other FY2s, or other sort of grades higher than that, make sure that you're supporting each other, because we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
And to have someone who sort of finishes early and then is just sort of not doing anything, I mean, that rarely happens, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah, when there's opportunities to support each other, be that person that says, do you know what, I'm going to help my colleague here. Mm. Like, even though you've done all your stuff, be the person who says, I'm going to help, because at some point, somebody's going to need to help you out. I think my third thing would be, you know, handing over effectively is really important. What we don't want to do is hand over a ton of stuff to the ADVAS doctors, the ones that you're handing over to, especially if they're things that, you know, you could have done if you'd prioritized and if you'd worked as a team a bit better. But equally, if there's stuff you need to hand over, then hand over effectively. And the reason I say effectively is because one of the problems that we all have, I think, is that we go home and worry about patients, that we should have done this, or we could have done this, or have I done this right? Actually, that is not good for anyone's mental health. I'm not saying it's, you know, you can fully, completely forget about things that have happened during the day, but as much as you can, if you can just hand over and know that it's safe, that what you've handed over this patient safely, you've told the next doctor what the issues are, what needs to be done, then you should, or I hope you can go home and sort of, I don't mean relax, but, you know, not worry about it as much. And there's something I spoke to a resident doctor about recently, which I thought was quite helpful. She was going home feeling really stressed and worrying about patients a lot. So we suggested, instead of getting into the car at the end of the day and just driving away, we suggested having 10 minutes. You leave the ward. It's as if you've gone home, but you go to the canteen, or you go to a quiet place where you sit in the car, and before you drive away, you do a quick review of your day. And have you done everything you wanted to do? Do you feel confident that you've been able to leave these things that you've handed over effectively? If you did it in the canteen, you might do that with a colleague and just talk your day through. Like a bit of a reflection.
Yeah.
That's right. And therefore, once you've reflected, okay, we're good to go.
Park it.
You can park it and then off you go. So that's been, I think that's helpful. And my other tip would be to say, you know, worry about the things that you can make a difference to. So if you can't make a difference to the patient load, then don't spend your energy worrying on that. Can you worry about the way you use your time? If you felt that you didn't know what to do in a certain clinical situation, could you learn about that and do it better next time? So if you can make a difference to the thing that's stressing you out, then worry about that and make a difference to those things. Don't just continue to do the same. Oh, I've seen that condition again. I still don't know what to do about it. It's like, well, will learn about it, and then you're not going to feel bad about it next time you come across it. So be proactive in your sort of CPD, be proactive in your sort of learning, be proactive in your reflection and handing over. And I'm not talking about writing a whole piece on reflective piece, but just 10 minutes with your colleague, I think is a really helpful thing. Those would be my sort of off the top of my head sort of tips.
Brilliant. I think those are awesome. And I think, you know, resident doctors listening right now, there's a lot that they can pick and benefit from that, you know, from handing over effectively peer to peer support, as you said, prioritization effectively, all these things they can they can really go a long way to ensure that you are protecting yourself.
And that's on your day to day. But to add into that, I'd say plan the fun stuff that you want to do as well. So just like I'm saying, be proactive about when you're going to book your annual leave, what you're going to do at weekends, meeting up with your friends. Don't just, because I meet so many resident doctors, I haven't got the energy to meet up with my friends, or like I haven't got around to using up my annual leave. Just be a little bit proactive and say, do you know what, I'm off in 3 weekends, my friend is off in 3 weekends, let's go to Ireland, or let's go to Stratford for the day, or let's just do something like good, you know, be proactive about the fun stuff that you want to do in life.
Do something outside of the hospital.
Yeah, like, and just, there's this one resident doctor who, we spoke about this. I was like, you know, be proactive about your holiday. And she, now, every time I see her, she's been on, she's just come back from Malaysia, I think. And then before that, she was in Turkey. She's like taking but she's do it. She took this advice and she's like, do you know what? When I go on holiday, I'm going to holiday properly. I'm like, yeah, exactly. Book it in, holiday properly. Use your weekends properly, you know.
Yeah, as you should.
As you should, yeah. Because if you're like me, you end up staying in bed for too long on the weekend, and then you watch too much Netflix, and you just like, it's like, okay, well, I might have relaxed a bit, but I've not sort of looked after my well-being very well by doing that.
Wow.
So.
Brilliant. Great. I think we've covered quite a bit of ground. And as I said, I think there's so much to pick from that. I think we'd like to probably hear more in future about the palliative care side of things. So maybe we'll have you on again at a certain point.
Well, maybe I could just say to finish then, just with, if anyone is struggling with their well-being, please get in touch. I don't know if you can put my details down.
We will put your details in the podcast.
If that, please feel free to get in touch and we'll meet up and talk things through.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast. That is it for today.
And as usual, if you'd like to take part in a podcast, feel free to contact us on any of our social media platforms, which is usually RGUC. And we will be sure to get back to you.
We'll see you next time.
Remember to stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS. And subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media, for more exclusive content and updates. Thanks for tuning in to the Right Chamber podcast. Until next time.